Thank you, Paul. It's nice to be here after getting away from the ice storm in D.C. and making it out. I guess I was lucky to be on the right airline yesterday. It does seem sort of odd, though, given the weather outside, to be talking about policies designed to inhibit global warming when we're all longing for warming right now, at least in a short-range sense. So the work I'm going to be talking about today is, I need to acknowledge that there are several co-authors who've worked on, I'm talking about a couple of pieces of research and some other work that we did, all related to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And those co-authors are Dallas Bertrau, who's also a senior fellow at Resources for the Future, Anthony Paul and Danny Kahn, who are research associate and research assistant, respectively, working with us. For those of you who aren't familiar with Resources for the Future, we are a 53-year-old nonprofit, nonpartisan, non-advocacy think tank or policy research institute in Washington, D.C. We do work on environmental, energy, and natural resource policy issues. The majority of the senior research staff are economists, although we have other folks, some lawyers and policy analysts as well. But we do tend to take an economic cost-benefit or cost-effectiveness approach to analyzing these policy questions. So today I'm going to talk primarily about REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and let's get started here. REGI is a program, the goal of which was to develop a multi-state strategy to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases in the region from electricity generators using a cap-and-trade approach. And this initiative was sort of the brainchild of the former governor of New York, Governor Pataki, who invited a number of governors from the region to join him in trying to come up with this program. There also are observers from some of the Canadian provinces as well. And the process sort of took about 2 years, and right before it ended, right before the governors got together to sign an agreement, two states that were involved ultimately dropped out. And you can see the states that were involved in the upper left-hand corner of this graph. They're all kind of there. The ones that aren't shaded in were primarily participating in observer status throughout this process, but all the ones that are darkly shaded fully anticipated that they were going to sign an agreement in the end. But when push came to shove in December of 2005, both Massachusetts and Rhode Island ended up not signing the agreement, in part because they were arguing for a provision that would cap the price of these emission allowances, and the rest of the states just weren't willing to go along. Also in part because the governor of Massachusetts and the governor of New York were both kind of candidates for president, and I don't know, they just had to hold their ground on this. So the remaining seven states that are shaded darkly there did sign an agreement in December of 2005. And because there is no regional-wide legal body to sort of implement this policy, it was going to be implemented on a state-by-state basis through either legislation and rulemaking or just through rulemaking. And so part of what they did was come up with a model rule. And that final model rule was released in August of 2006. Earlier in 2006, the state of Maryland, which had been participating as an observer, passed a law that required Maryland to join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And I'm going to talk more about that process, what that led to a little bit later on in this talk. But then what happened at the end of 2006 was there was a gubernatorial election in Massachusetts, and the new governor said, indeed, he was going to sign the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And so both Massachusetts and Rhode Island ended up signing back on last month. And as I mentioned, this program is going to be implemented on a state-by-state basis. So what's going to be happening next is the states are going to be making decisions about what they're going to do. Well, what does the program entail? It starts in 2009. And it affects electricity generating units over 25 megawatts and bigger in size. It essentially stabilizes emissions of CO2 at current levels. The caps, that takes effect in 2009 are based on a range of emissions over a range of historic years early in this decade just a slight bit higher to allow for growth in the economy. And then emissions are frozen through 2015, and then they're ratcheted down to 10% below that level by 2019. Within this program, it's possible to reduce emissions early on and then bank the allowances that you don't use for use in later years. And that's an important provision, and we'll hear more about a program in Europe that doesn't have such a provision later. It's also possible in this program to, instead of reducing emissions at your facility, actually reduce emissions in some other sector or some other region potentially through these emissions offsets. Excuse me. And there are limits on that. There are very particular definitions within the model rule. I think it's something like a quarter to a third of the pages in the model rule talk about what is acceptable as an emissions offset. And that's because the concern is you don't want to be paying people to reduce emissions. Say, for example, of methane from a landfill, if they were already going to do it anyway. You want this to be additional emission reductions of greenhouse gases. And so they're very careful about that. In addition, they also limit the use of offsets to a certain percentage of emissions, but that percentage goes up as the price of these CO2 allowances goes up. So if the price reaches certain thresholds, then you can actually rely more on these emissions offsets. And ultimately, if the price rises to $10 a ton, you can go into the international market and actually purchase offsets that are available there. The way that the allowances in this emissions cap and trade program are distributed to affected sources is a sort of a two-step approach. First, there's an apportionment state of a CO2 allocation to all facilities in that state, and that depends on historic emissions and also sort of a result of a bargaining process. So for example, Vermont, which has only really one emitting generator that falls into that's covered by the rule, got us a not insignificant apportionment of allowances, and that's because it's not just what your historic emissions were that determine this, it's other factors as well. And then in the second stage, the states are responsible for deciding how allowances are going to be allocated to particular sources. As a part of the Memorandum of Understanding, all the states agreed that they would dedicate a minimum of 25% of these emission allowances to what are termed consumer benefit or strategic energy purposes, or sometimes for shorthand referred to as public benefit purposes. And the assumption is that those allowances would be auctioned off, and then the revenue would be used either to subsidize energy efficiency, to subsidize perhaps renewable technologies, subsidize R&D, or to offset the rate impacts for certain classes of customers, perhaps. But 25% was a floor, and several states, Vermont, New York, Maine, and Massachusetts so far, have declared their intentions to actually auction off 100% of emission allowances. So a large part of what I'm going to talk to you today is this looking at this issue of what it makes sense to do in terms of allocating these allowances. So indeed, this is the outline of the rest of my presentation. We've actually done some analysis at Resources for the Future looking at different approaches to allocating allowances, and I'm going to talk about how they affect the value of the firm and whether or not, if you think that part of implementing this policy should be compensating firms that are adversely affected, well, how does that work with different approaches to allocation? I'm going to talk a little bit about a workshop that we did on allowance auctions, and this is particularly relevant given that so many states are deciding to auction off so many of the allowances. And then talk about a study that we recently completed about Maryland joining RGGI and what we found there. Okay. So on the question of allocating allowances, with very few exceptions, existing emission cap and trade programs such as the SO2 program under Title IV or the NOx program under the CIPCOL, they initially distribute most of the emission allowances that are created by these programs for free to sources. But economists who study this issue of allowance allocation, they typically find that really a better approach would be to auction off the allowances. It's particularly true in a situation such as the case in electricity markets a lot of time, where the price of a particular product is different from its marginal cost. But there's also cases where another argument which suggests that if the revenue from the auction of allowance is going to be used to offset reliance on other taxes, such as labor taxes or capital taxes, that are in the economy providing disincentives for working or investing, you'd rather be taxing the bad than taxing these productive efforts in the economy. I'm not going to really talk about that argument, but that is out there. But offsetting this, there are, of course, a lot of justifications for allocating allowances for free. And one important one, particularly politically, is that you want to compensate firms that are being affected. So thinking about that particular justification for a minute, how many, if you've got a cap and trade program, how many allowances should you give away for free? And an important consideration there is how much compensation is justified. Should you compensate them 100% for their costs or what? So these are questions we're going to consider. And when I say here that when you're thinking about allocation, that regulated entities may not bear all the costs, when I refer to regulated entities, I'm talking about entities that are subject to the emissions cap and trade program. And the point is that if you, particularly if you're functioning in a competitive market, if you're subject to this cap and trade approach to limiting emissions, even if you get an emission allowance for free, you could fully be expected, you would totally be expected, to pass the cost of using that allowance on in the market price of electricity, and we're going to talk about that. So just the point is that just because you're imposing costs on firms, it doesn't mean necessarily that those costs are going to totally be reflected in lost profits. There could be, it could end up being the case that consumers end up paying. We'll talk about situations where that's true and where it's not. But we have evidence, both modeling evidence and actual experience, that shows that firms can profit or have profited from carbon dioxide regulation. And here, I'm going to show you some graphs from the European program. This is a supply stack graph for the Nordic electricity system. Several analysts in Europe have looked at the effects of a emission cap and trade system on the price of electricity in the European market. And this slide is from a study for Norway of the relationship between allowance costs and electricity price. What this shows is that the dispatch curve for the system and the effect of the CO2 trading program on costs of different technologies and on the electricity price. So in Norway, about 70% of the electricity is CO2 free because it either comes from hydropower or nuclear power. But the electricity price most of the time is set by either the emitting coal-fired generators or perhaps a slightly more expensive oil-fired generators. And all of those generators, as you'll see here, but the difference between the lower thick blue line and the higher thick blue line have their costs affected by the implementation of the EU ETS. Actually, it's not that difference that shows the cost difference. It's the difference between the chunky bar here and the higher black line. So that shows you the effect of having to hold and surrender these CO2 allowances every time you generate electricity on the cost of supplying electricity with those particular technologies. And so what you see is that given a particular level of demand, the price of electricity goes up substantially, but only those generators at the far end of the supply stack are actually incurring costs. The non-emitting generators aren't, but they get to reap windfall profits as a result of this policy. So there's lots of economic rents here. And you can see in this slide comparing for the a time period before the EU ETS came into effect, which was at the beginning of 2005, And into the first 5 months of that program, a comparison between what's happening with electricity prices, which are shown in blue and measured off the right-hand axis, and allowance prices, which are shown in pink and measured off, the left-hand axis, is that when allowance prices started to run up early in 2005, electricity prices ran up right along with them. So there is an effect here, and that consumers in the European market ended up paying much higher electricity prices because of this program. This stops at in the middle of 2005, and when Paul and I do our tag team presentation of Reed's slides, you'll see a more up-to-date pattern of what's been going on with the prices in the EU ETFs, and you'll see that it's been kind of a bumpy ride. That prices have been going up and down for a variety of reasons. Okay, so turning now to modeling results and thinking about this question of allocation, specifically focused on the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, we have a national electricity market simulation model. It's sort of similar in character to the electricity part of the National Energy Modeling System. We call our model HAIKU, and we use it to look at the effects of a number of environmental policies affecting the electricity sector on various aspects of the performance of that sector. So we've used this model to study this question of, well, how do different approaches to allowance allocation affect affect the region and the electricity markets in this Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative region. The analysis that I'm reporting on here was done before decisions were made about what the caps would be, and so we started with sort of the talk at the time, which was that emissions would actually ultimately be ratcheted down to 20% below current levels, when actually it's only going to be 10% below. So the policy scenario that we're looking at is stricter than the actual RGGI policy, which means our quantitative results might be off a bit, but I think the qualitative findings are still very relevant. So what we've done a number of papers looking at this question, and we've looked at a number of different approaches to distributing allowances, but I'm just going to talk about two approaches here today. One is selling 100% of those CO2 allowances, and a second approach is giving them away to incumbent generators based on historic performance, so essentially 1999 generation shares. And I should point out that in the three approaches that we're considering here, we're only looking at allocation of allowances to actual emitters. There are other proposals out there that talk about allocating allowances to renewables or incremental nuclear generation, and we've looked at those and some work we've done, but I'm not going to talk about that today. And basically, the point I want to get across when thinking about this question of, well, how many allowances do you have to give away to compensate firms, is just look at, well, how are firms affected by different approaches here? So here we've got a graph that looks at the 23 largest firms doing business, the 23 largest electricity generating firms doing business in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, 9-state region. We often refer to this region as classic RGGI, because as RGGI starts to change, that's anyway, the original region. And this graph shows, under the two different approaches to distributing allowances, what happens to these firms. What you see here with the pink line, which is the historic approach, and the yellow line, which is the auction approach. Well, under the historic approach, you give these allowances away for free. Everybody, all the firms rise in value, or at least are pretty much made held even. So everybody likes the historic approach, and with maybe one exception, most of the firms actually are, their assets are worth more after the policy goes into effect than before it's in effect. And the reason this happens, one of the reasons this happens is most of these firms do own at least some diversity in their mix of assets, you know, lower and higher emitting. And also, within this region, there isn't really a lot of coal-fired generation. But anyway, the mix of assets sort of helps to shore up the value of these. And the fact that in this region, prices are set in competitive markets. Those allowances are given away for free. When firms go to bid into the ISO market, they're going to bid a price that reflects the opportunity cost of using that allowance. We've done other work that looks at the contrast with regulated regions, where in regulated regions, if you get an allowance for free and your price that you're charging for electricity is based on your average cost of service, then you're not going to pass the price of that allowance on to your electricity customers because you didn't bear a cost associated with it. And so you got a pretty very different story when focusing on regulated regions. Well, then comparing the pink line to the yellow line, what happens if everybody has to pay for all these allowances? And there you see that just, again, considering the assets that these firms own that are located in the 9-state classic RGGI region, 9 of the firms still gain value under an auction because their lines are above the zero axis there. And the rest are losing money. But it's important to point out that this graph focuses on assets that are located in the RGGI region. And firms that are located in RGGI also do business in other regions. So what happens if we include the value of those other assets? And that's what we show on the next slide. So here, just focusing on, well, okay, we're going to sell 100% of these allowances. Again, what we used to characterize as an extreme case, but now that a lot of regions are doing this, that's less. And now that a lot of states have said that's what they're going to do, it's not really an extreme case. So this graph shows, well, what happens if you bring in assets that are over the border, essentially. So that would be like firms that own plants that are located in Pennsylvania, or at the time we did this analysis in Maryland, states that aren't in RGGI, but participate in markets that are at least partially covered by RGGI, such as the PJM market. And we find there that it turns out as a result of this policy going into effect, they're able to sell electricity at higher prices, but those assets outside the RGGI region don't bear the cost. So the yellow line here just focuses on the assets outside the region, and you'll see that it rarely dips below zero. And when you combine the pink line with the yellow line and you get the purple line with the X's, that's the combined region, that in several cases, firms are actually doing better. Their combined assets, both within the RGGI region and outside the RGGI region, are going up higher than just the assets within the RGGI region. So when thinking about these firms and how they're affected, it makes a difference whether you focus on just the assets in the regulated region or assets that are beyond that. When we look, not just focusing on the 23 firms, but look at all the firms in the region and kind of put these numbers together, what do we find about compensation? What are the losses resulting from this policy look like in the aggregate, and how do they compare to the value of the CO2 emissions allowances here? Well, again, it depends on how you group the assets out there. Typically, when people, there have been a number of studies that look at, well, how do you compensate the industry for a carbon policy? And some folks at Stanford have done some work on this, and folks at Charles River Associates and other places, when looking at a federal policy. And typically, they look at the industry as sort of an aggregate kind of monolith. In other words, we saw under the slide that compared an auction to a historic approach that under a pure auction, some firms were actually going to be winners. The second column in this table here that says compensation of industry focuses on a situation where all the winners in the industry are sort of offsetting losses to losers in the industry. And so you just have the industry as a whole. And there we see, well, if you're just looking at the 9-state RGGI region, if we gave away 29% of these emission allowances, that would exactly offset the losses to the industry as a whole. If, in fact, we consider all the assets in the larger region, which includes all the regions immediately basically trading with the RGGI states, we find that you don't even need to compensate them at all because they're actually winning as a result of this policy. But really, that's probably not the best way to think about compensation because it's kind of a firm-by-firm sort of thing. And so the first column says is about addressing just those firms that lose value. So in other words, firms that are winners as a result of this policy, they get to keep their winnings. We're just going to focus on the firms that are losers as a result of this policy. What percentage of the allowances would you have to give them? And again, assuming that you knew our model was correct, telling you what they could lose, and you knew who the losers were, if you're just talking about assets within the RGGI region, it's roughly half of the allowances. If you're talking about the assets in the broader region, it's about a third. So you could give them a third, and that means you have two-thirds of the allowances available to auction and devote to public benefit purposes. Again, this is assuming that you're compensating them 100% for their losses that result in the policy, and whether or not that's the desirable policy goal is an open question here. So that's one of the caveats I wanted to raise about this compensation work. Also, throughout what I've been talking about, we've really been assuming that we're just going to compensate the electricity generators, but there are other parties that are adversely affected by this policy, including electricity ratepayers. If you were to auction off allowances, that would create revenues that could be used for that to compensate other folks, perhaps through, you know, like the Alaska pipeline, where you auction off rights to the Alaska pipeline, and people who live in Alaska get a check every year. You could have a similar type of system, perhaps, here for emission allowances. So that, you know, there are multiple ways to think about this question of compensation. And in fact, it turns out that, as I mentioned before, several of the states are opting for auctioning off 100%. So whether it's 100% or a smaller percentage, there are issues here around, well, what is the best way to actually run one of these auctions for allowances? So one of the things that we did in this past summer was to help the RGGI folks and the policymakers and stakeholders in the RGGI region think about how to go about carrying out an allowance auction. We convened a group of auction experts to talk about their experiences with auctions and come up with some recommendations for RGGI. And those recommendations took the form of a roadmap to implementing allowance auctions. We talked about how it's important for folks in the region to articulate the goals and consistent auction designs. I mean, here you've got an issue where this program is actually being run by a whole bunch of different states, but you want to coordinate what's happening across the states. You want an auction process that's really going to facilitate the discovery of allowance prices. You want something that's going to have relatively low administrative costs, and that's going to work well with the existing over-the-counter market, which is probably going to continue to, you know, function a lot in terms of people actually trading these allowances as they look forward to meeting compliance dates and things. So there's a number of goals that the RGGI folks wanted to need to keep in mind in terms of thinking about designing these auctions. We learned that, you know, there's a number of important parameters that have to be thought about. How frequently do you have these auctions? Are you going to limit participation by certain folks? A lot of the generators wanted to argue that we shouldn't let financial people participate in these auctions and just let the generators participate because they worried they couldn't get allowances. But there's a lot of issues associated with that. You know, how many allowances do you want to auction off at a time? Or do you want to limit how many people can buy at once? And then in terms of the process going forward, you know, because this is a multi-state process that was very much driven by stakeholders, participation by folks in the industry, environmental groups and others, you know, they're going to continue to be involved in thinking about how an auction would work. And there's intentions, I think, to move forward with actually doing some experiments that would identify ways in which people could potentially gain this auction and do things that could have that adverse effect. Some folks would argue that such experiments should have been conducted in California, for example, in their energy auction. So the next topic I want to talk about is related to expanding the regional greenhouse gas initiative. And I realize that sitting here in Florida probably seems really far away, but despite that all those states are located in the Northeast, there really is a diversity of the composition of their generating assets among the different states. And in particular, Maryland and Pennsylvania, who set through the process largely in observer status, they're much more dependent on coal than the original classic red states. But Maryland, which ended up deciding to join RGGI, is a fairly coal-intensive state. So I think it could be of interest to think about, well, if expanding regional programs is sort of the way climate policy is going to happen in the next few years, and we can come back in the question and answer period to whether that's true, then it's useful to think about, well, what about different states, particularly states that have a high composition of coal in their generators. So when Maryland, the governor of Maryland, former governor of Maryland, signed the Healthy Air Act, it called for Maryland to join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in June of this year, and it also called for simultaneously, actually ended up happening beforehand, there to be a study of what the effects of Maryland joining RGGI would be on things like the fuel mix for electricity generation in Maryland, generator profitability, electricity demand and price, emissions of CO2, the price of these RGGI CO2 emission allowances, will that have an effect on that, as well as electricity reliability and the overall state economy of Maryland. So they made a decision to go ahead, but they also called for a study with a provision that they could kind of back out if the news was not good. We were involved in that study, and it just came out a couple of weeks ago. I think it's important because Maryland's participation in RGGI is not just going to affect Maryland, it's also going to affect the whole picture of what's happening in the RGGI region. So what we did was we used the same simulation model that I mentioned before, but here we really, since we have information about what the RGGI rule looks like, we tried to come very close to modeling that rule. There's some issues here because the rule covers a lot of generating sources that actually don't sell to the grid, and those sources aren't in our model. So we weren't exactly able to represent it, but we tried to come close by adjusting the caps we modeled for the fact that we were excluding some generating sources. So, but there's going to be some differences between our results and results of other folks that have modeled the RGGI policy for that and other reasons. So what do we find when we look at this? Well, one thing is in terms of how electricity is being supplied in Maryland, it turns out that just stabilizing these emissions at this roughly current levels doesn't really seem to have a big impact on coal-fired generation in the state. The generators that actually get hit within the state and end up reducing their generation relative to a forecast where Maryland is not part of RGGI are the natural gas generators. And also, when the RGGI policy existed in the 9 RGGI states, but not in Maryland, Maryland was a source sort of emissions leakage. In other words, power was being shipped from Maryland to the east because you could get it a little bit cheaper and that they didn't have the cost of complying with the policy. But now that they do have the cost of complying with the policy, there's less exports of power from Maryland to the east. And as a result, net imports of power are going down. So what you see here in comparing these two bars, first, not a really big effect. Second, a really small effect on coal, but a bigger effect on natural gas, which is a small component of the generation system. And third, an effect on net imports. Why is natural gas taking the hit here? I mean, you wouldn't think that it would be because it's got lower emission rates than the coal. And the reason is that the RGGI policy calls for 25% of the emission allowances to go towards consumer benefit. And the way we modeled that was that 25% of the revenue from selling these emission allowances was going to be funneled back into purchasing sort of megawatt hours, so to speak. So got information from the folks who actually modeled the RGGI policy about supply curves that they were using for energy efficiency. We did some adjustments to those curves to kind of raise the cost a little bit because we thought they were somewhat optimistic. But still, if you take 25% of those allowances and devote them to energy efficiency, and we also have some other restrictions that would raise the cost a little bit above just purely using the supply curve, the fact is that the policy is going to lead to a reduction in electricity demand. We'll see that. That's sort of the picture, a little bit of the picture about what happens to the composition of generators. It's natural gas that's really taking a hit, and that's because at the margin you actually have lower demand for electricity because of these energy efficiency programs. So what happens to the price of electricity when Maryland joins RGGI? Well, it turns out there really is no effect on price. What this graph shows is for one time block, so our model's divided up into numerous time blocks, the supply of electricity in Maryland without Maryland being in RGGI, and then the higher cost with Maryland joining RGGI, which is the pink line, and also what happens to demand for electricity. And again, because money's being recycled into energy efficiency, the demand curve, which before the policy is given by the blue dotted line, shifts down to the pink dotted line, and essentially things kind of wash out here. So supply curve shifting up, but the demand curve shifting down, and there really is no effect on price. So this is just illustrative of one time block. We could have different pictures for different time blocks, but the story is basically the same. What's happening to emissions? Now here's where it gets interesting, because you've got this largely coal-fired state joining RGGI. You know, what's going to happen here? What this slide shows is now looking at a region that's RGGI but now includes Maryland, and breaking down what is the cumulative effect of emissions over the entire forecast period of this new policy of Maryland signing up for RGGI. And what you see here is that emissions of CO2 from electricity generators in Maryland go down quite a bit. Emissions of CO2, however, from electricity generators in the other states in RGGI actually go up. And you know, not to the extent to offset this, there's still about seven million tons of cumulative reductions from electricity generation. But the other thing that happens here is when Maryland joins RGGI, that increases the pool of offsets that are available. And that's because Maryland is such a heavily coal-fired utility that the level of the cap goes up by, different estimates vary, but between 20 and 25% just by virtue of this one state joining. So their emissions are a substantial fraction of the total emissions in the region. And because offsets are keyed off of the level of the total emissions in the region, they create a whole bunch of new offsets that are available to generators throughout the region. Assuming that these offsets are additional and that really they're verified reductions in emissions of greenhouse gases that wouldn't have happened had these utilities not stepped in to purchase them, you get the equivalent of 19 million tons more reductions of CO2 from outside the electricity sector for a total of 26 million tons. So, you know, there's an effect of Maryland joining, a lot of it comes from offsets being brought on. What about allowance prices? So here what we see is that the blue line is what allowance prices were in the classic RGGI region without Maryland, and the pink line is what they were with Maryland joining RGGI. And we see that Maryland joining up causes allowance prices to be lower than they otherwise would be. And I should point out here, you know, they're going up over time. That makes sense because the caps are getting tighter over time. There is full banking of allowances over time. So some sense the rate at which they can go up over time is kind of constrained by that banking situation. The actual levels of these prices could be off a little bit, and again, that's because you know the units that we're representing in the model don't include some substantially inside self-generating units. But I think so that the quantity of what allowance prices are predicted to be here, there's a fair amount of uncertainty about that, and these predictions are very different from predictions you would see from the RGGI folks themselves. But I think the qualitative effect that we find that allowance prices in the region are going to fall as a result of Maryland joining RGGI is robust to which facilities are included in the model. So let me stop now before going to Reed's presentation with a few concluding thoughts about the future of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. One is, will state-level programs, the implementation of this program, proceed as planned? You know, the states are going through their rulemaking processes and putting out proposed rules, and generators and other folks are responding. You know, it'll be interesting to see whether provisions like the proposal to auction off 100% of these allowances in various states actually survive this rulemaking process. It's also interesting to think about what states will be next to join REGI. Some folks that I know that are participating in the California initiative have proposed that, well, California could make the situation a lot easier if they just joined REGI. So, you know, who knows if that will happen. That's probably not as likely as other states kind of creeping down the East Coast. Pennsylvania is a big question mark here, but it'd just be interesting to see what happens as it moves forward. Also, REGI is very focused just on the electricity sector, just on CO2. Will it be expanded to focus on other sectors, because it's going to be an important part of solving the problem? And will it be expanded to include other gases? We don't know. But I think lastly, you know, we've seen these regional approaches pop up in large part, I think, because the federal government just hasn't decided to do anything in the form of imposing actual restrictions on CO2 emissions. At least on the congressional side of things, in the House and the Senate, that appears to be changing. If there were some federal policy in the next couple of years, what's going to happen to these regional approaches? And it becomes sort of an interesting, potentially political battle, because if the intentions to auction off 100% of these allowances go forward and the states are collecting money for doing that, they may be hesitant to give that up if there's some sort of federal program. So on that note, I'll just leave you with my contact information and then pretend to be Reed. Or you're going to have to.
I was going to, while we're trying to get the presentation changed, I was going to open the floor to questions for parents and parents, which is very interesting implications for the utility industry here. I'm sure that there are some questions about some of the potential counterintuitive results that they've come up with.
You know, that's a good question that I don't know the answer to. I do know that it raised Maryland prices of electricity. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but that's a good question. Well, okay. The allocation to states is based on that plus some political considerations. The allocation to sources, in four of the REGI states, in four of the now 10 REGI states, they've said, we're going to auction off 100%. So in other words, if you have to, everybody has to go and buy them. That's in the proposed rulemakings that are going on in those states. In Vermont, it actually was passed in a law. In the other states, it's part of a proposed rulemaking, and we'll remain to be seen if that survives, but basically everybody would have to buy all their allowances. The memorandum of understanding had 25% would have to be bought, but everyone would, you know, 25% would be available to buy, and then 75% would be allocated based on whatever the state decided to do. It might not be that historic case that we looked at. It could be something like an updating case. There's a bill that's been introduced in the past several sessions of Congress, sponsored by Senator Carper of Delaware, where he proposes not just capping CO2 from electricity generators, but a sort of approach that would kind of nationalize the CARE program. So stricter national caps on SO2 and Knox, and I'm not sure if mercury is tradable in his bill. But in that bill, a large percentage of the allowances would be given away for free, but it would be an updating basis. So it would be your share of generation in recent years, and therefore providing an incentive for folks to increase their share of generation. It wouldn't be based on historic emissions. So just because you're giving allowances away for free doesn't necessarily have to be based on historic emissions. That or historic heat input, which is the way it was done in the SO2 program. In the NOx program, different states have taken different approaches, and some of them have actually used this updating approach because they feel that it provides an incentive for, well, more opportunity for cleaner generators to get a bigger share of allowances because it's, you know, gas is in it for the same amount as coal. Some places adjust for that, though, because they do want to compensate the coal generators, which have higher NOx emission rates. So there's a variety of different approaches. Yes. Right. There are provisions for penalties, and I can tell you what they are in the EU, but I can't remember precisely what they are in REGI. I think it's a multiple of the going market price, and you reduce your allocation of allowances in the future. Now, if they're sold at auction, I'm not really sure what that means. It might reduce the total amount that they're going to auction off, but that would be sort of punishing other people. So in other words, there is a penalty that you would have to bear, which I believe in REGI is it's like 2 times the going price. And you have to pay that. So you could make the decision that, you know, you'd rather, if you think the going price is going to be low, that you'd rather just pay the penalty.
And not buy a additional.
Well, right, but you know, it makes more sense to buy an allowance if it's available. So. Yes, they are a way to fund the social benefits program, and one of the things might be, you know, giving, like I said, the Alaska pipeline model where every family affected by this policy gets $5 a year off their, or whatever, off their electricity bill. Or it might be actually funding energy efficiency programs, which is the way we modeled it. But it's not necessarily the way that the revenues are going to be used. Or it could.
And your offsets are, I don't know.
Okay, so offsets would be things like purchasing reductions in greenhouse gases such as sulfur hexafluoride emissions from transmission, from the transmission system, from transformers. There are, assuming that there's no incentive to do that out there in the marketplace, there are programs that put into place that you can pay folks to do that and then get credits. Or capping emissions from methane, from landfills, or afforestation in places where trees weren't going to be planted. Right. That's up to the states. So the states that are doing 100% auction, no, everybody is subject to the same term. You can go buy these allowances at an auction, or you can wait and buy them on the secondary market. The states could decide to do something for new sources, but I haven't seen anything specific about that.
Okay, question down here for this question. I saw in the presentation that the effects of the 23 largest, did you get a similar analysis for the 23 smallest and maybe 23 in the middle? Is there a difference between the cumulative effects for the smaller generators as opposed to larger ones?
No, we didn't, although when we look at the total picture, everybody's included.
Right. If you see the positive benefits at the top
I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. It's somewhere in the comparison between that slide and the one that shows the whole industry. Certainly, in overall dollars, the answer is no. But per, you know, what they own in assets, it could be that they're bearing more, but I don't know the answer to that.
And Kevin, you said that, and you had a dispatch for a couple earlier, you say that y'all have a little bit.
Okay. We in the REGI region, I'm talking about HUD price, in the REGI region, we're assuming that wholesale prices are set at marginal cost, so it's a market-based system. We've looked at other, and that's because all those states really have restructured. We've looked at national programs in other work, and there we see a big spread between what happens as a result of introducing cap-and-trade programs to prices in competitive regions and in regulated regions. And in regulated regions, you know, this really very small price impact if the allowances are grandfathered. If the specific proposal that we looked at was the Bingaman proposal in another paper, where the question that the Senate committee raised was, well, what if we, the Bingaman proposal is an economy-wide cap on CO2 emissions, and the thinking is that that would be imposed at the upstream level on fuel, say. But there's a lot of questions about allocation, so they wanted to compare that to a program where, for the electricity sector, they get their allowances for free. And it's a big difference in terms of ratepayer factors. If they're all allocated upstream, that's essentially similar to making them buy it at auction, because that means that the price of using an allowance is embedded in the price that the generators pay for fuel, and so it's going to be there for average cost regions, that it's going to be there for marginal cost regions. So they're both going to see the prices go up.
Other questions or comments? Okay, I guess Karen's going to look at
we're winging it.
We agreed to split up a brief Mark's presentation with Karen covering the California developments and climate change policy. I'm going to talk about what I call about the emissions trading system, some of the issues with the design of that mechanism, and mostly the problems with that mechanism. And then we could flip to there. So, Karen, I will turn it over to you once again. And thanks for appreciating it.
No problem, Paul. So in California, you've got a very ambitious and far-looking into the future initiative, and the intention is to cover a much broader segment of the economy than the REGI program. It started, I guess, Governor Schwarzenegger's involvement in it started in this June 2005 executive order that set these very ambitious goals of, you know, by 2010, getting emissions down to 2000 levels, 2020 down to 1990 levels, and by 2050, reducing emissions to 80% below 1990 levels. Okay. And then this was a little bit more formality and shorter-term goals and process about how this is going to happen was added by two bills that were passed in the California state legislature. One, Assembly Bill 32, which the governor signed this past fall, requires the California Air Resources Board to start this process of developing regulations to achieve these goals, basically greenhouse gas emissions to 25% reductions by the year 2020. And that's going to start with some mandatory standards put in place by 2012, and they're going to start in the interim figuring out ways to measure what existing emissions are. Also, for a particular interest to the electricity sector is SB 1368, and that essentially establishes a greenhouse gas performance standard that's imposed on any new contract or new construction of base load generating facilities. And the performance standard is that they have to hit the emissions rate, the CO2 emission rate, cannot exceed the CO2 emission rate of a combined cycle natural gas power plant. So it's a pretty strict requirement there in terms of who the load-serving entities are going to be allowed to contract with for generation sources in the future. In moving ahead with designing this policy, the Air Resources Board created something known as the Market Advisory Committee, and that's providing advice to them on program design. It turns out that my colleague Dallas Bertrand is one of the representatives on this, but it's a diverse group. It includes representatives from industry, some academics, folks from environmental groups, and participants from governments like a gentleman that was actually involved in REGI from New York is participating, but they also have folks from the EU and the UK, and that's because of the special relationship Governor Schwarzenegger has developed with the UK on this issue, and representatives from the US EPA as well. Brian McLean was actually involved in the SO2 trading program is on this committee. So they're starting their public meetings this month, and they want to wrap up everything by June. So in the interim between now and 2012, there are all these deadlines. They need to sort of, they want to figure out early action measures so they can kind of get things going while they're working. They want to establish the caps. They're going to figure out reporting rules so they can keep track of what things are going on currently. And they want to adopt regulations by the beginning of 2011. And the deal is they want to achieve maximum technologically feasible reductions and also cost-effective reductions. They're not just limiting themselves to market mechanisms, but they're thinking of sort of a hybrid approach that includes both. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Paul to get my questions.